It wasn't what they'd had planned for their lives. Or maybe just a little. An ordinary life had been the most likely scenario. Marriage, a child, living in suburbia. But then something else had taken over. An urge, drawing them deeper and deeper into the darkness. Until the worst had happened. And then it happened again. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 172, The Serial Crimes of the Smedels. This episode is sponsored by the soon-to-be-released movie, Cellar Door. After experiencing the tragedy of miscarriage, John and Sarah are looking for a fresh start in a new home when they find themselves in the most unexpected of situations. Instead of buying a new home, they're gifted one by the mysterious Emmett. The man says he wants to leave his past behind, just like John and Sarah. And he's more than happy to hand over his home with no payment required, as long as the couple stick to one rule. They can never open the cellar door. It seems like a no-brainer, but when strange and terrifying things start happening in the house, the cellar door beckons, and there's no way to know what horrors lie beyond. With an all-star cast including Lawrence Fishburne, Jordana Brewster, and Scott Speedman, Cellar Door is in cinemas in South Africa from Friday the 3rd of January 2025, and it's a must-watch. A huge thank you to Cellar Door for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shoutouts to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Karen Kaufman, Kayla Everett, Linda, Natalie Wolf, Helen DeToy, Antoinette van der Plas, and Rutendo Kutito for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. This episode was first released on the Patreon feed in November 2023. This and last week, I've released Patreon-exclusive episodes into the regular feed to, firstly, give myself a bit of a break, but also to give listeners who haven't yet signed up for a Patreon a little taste of what you could be getting every month for as little as about 19 Rand. From next week, I'll be back to releasing regular episodes on the podcast again. Oh, and Happy New Year. And thank you so much for all of your support in 2024. Have you ever looked over at your neighbours and wondered what goes on behind the closed doors of their home? Has anything ever happened in your neighbourhood so horrific that you simply could not believe you lived so close to people who could commit such heinous crimes? Today's case is the perfect example of how cold-blooded killers don't wear signs on their foreheads. It's the very reason every single time some heinous killer is captured, you see someone on the news saying, "He was such a nice guy, though." This case is about the really lovely couple next door. The one with a young child, bright smiles, and a neighbourly attitude, who simultaneously harboured murderous intentions. In researching this case, I used several online resources, several media articles, as well as court documents. So let's get into episode 172, The Serial Crimes of the Smeddles.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Craig and Bridget Smeddle met in 1995 when Craig was 14 and Bridget was 13. The pair were high school sweethearts and dated throughout their secondary schooling. Craig struggled significantly in school. Although he was very intelligent, he got mixed up with the wrong crowd and started using drugs. By the time he was in his early 20s, he was regularly using heroin. He and Bridget remained together for the most part, but soon they would be separated by distance when Craig decided to move to the UK for a while to work. When he moved to the UK, he was finally able to break the hold that his drug habits had on him, and while there, he became a qualified website designer and an accredited Microsoft technician. We don't have a lot of information about what Bridget was doing during this time, but it certainly seems that their relationship continued to some extent, even while Craig was not in the country. Bridget's level of drug use during this time is also unknown, but she certainly was at least an occasional user. It would later emerge that one of the possible reasons that Craig had left to go and work and live in the UK is because he'd started building a criminal record at a relatively young age. He was convicted on several occasions for crimes relating to fraud and possession of drugs, and given suspended sentences on the condition that he attended drug rehabilitation. Bridget had clearly also not stayed on the straight and narrow, because she also had a record for damage to property, for which she was given the option of a fine or 3 years in prison. When Craig returned to South Africa, he and Bridget's relationship started up in full force again, and unfortunately, so did their respective drug habits. This is often one of the reasons that people in recovery are warned not to get into committed relationships too soon after getting clean, and definitely not to return to relationships that they'd had while they were using that might trigger their use again. And this is clearly what happened with Craig and Bridget. As much as the pair might have loved one another and perhaps felt that they were meant to be, they were clearly not good for each other. And as soon would be shown, that wasn't just about their drug use either. In 2011, Bridget fell pregnant with Craig's child and they got married. But not even this new addition helped to curb their heroin habits. The Smeddles were living in Observatory in the Western Cape and soon became heavily indebted to their drug dealer, Edwin Chukwumba. The man continued to supply them, although he increasingly became insistent that they needed to settle their debt or he would stop supply. On the 19th of July 2011, Craig and Bridget arranged a meeting with Edwin. They told the man that they wanted to buy drugs from him and also to settle their outstanding debt. Edwin welcomed them into his home in Bedford Street Observatory, but soon realized that the pair were there for something very different. Although Bridget and Craig would both claim that they had acted in self-defense that day, the evidence would show differently. Edwin's body would be discovered later that afternoon by a friend who'd come to pay him a visit. Still wrapped around his neck was a homemade wire garrote that had been used to strangle him. The wire had cut into Edwin's neck, so he'd also suffered bleeding from that area. But his killers hadn't stopped there, and they'd also proceeded to stab him while he was suffocating to death. It wouldn't take long for police to put two and two together in Edwin's murder, though, and the sum led to the Smeddles. Other drug dealers in the area knew the couple well and informed police that they had owed Edwin a lot of money and they should definitely be looked at. When people involved in illegal activities are murdered, it's often either disagreements over territory or someone trying to take them out for some other benefit. In the Smeddles case, they clearly thought that by killing Edwin, they would get away with not having to pay him, and also they got away with a lot of free heroin that day. But soon, police were knocking on their door, and the pair were arrested in early 2012. The couple both pled not guilty to Edwin's murder and indicated that their defense was going to be that they'd acted to defend their own lives when Edwin had attacked them both over the debt disagreement. Neither denied knowing Edwin or having owed him a significant amount of money for drugs they'd purchased. In fact, it soon became clear that they were going to attempt to use their drug addiction to gain leniency from the court when they applied for bail. Another point that was put forward was that their son, who was just over 1 year old at the time, needed his parents. A trial date was set, and the pair were granted bail. The trial for the murder of Edwin Chikumba would be a long and drawn-out affair, and the delays didn't come from the prosecution side. When the trial started, the Smeddles' attorney went all out against each of the prosecution's witnesses, and although the state rested their case relatively quickly, the defense's case would take up the bulk of the eventual 4 years that the trial would last. As they began to present their case, it became clear that no expense had been spared in funding the defense, which seemed strange, considering their inability to pay their debts had seemingly been what had led them to require a defense in the first place. One of the rather top-level witnesses that the couple presented in their defense was forensic expert David Klatzau. Klatzau is a world-renowned expert in several fields of forensics and has authored several books on the various cases he's worked on. He's also often called in by defense teams to assess evidence in an attempt to disprove, or prove, if that's the way it goes, the prosecution's theory in a given case. In the case of Edwin Chikumba's murder, Klatzau had looked at the alleged murder weapon, the wire garrote, and the injuries sustained by the victim. And he testified that he didn't believe that the injuries had been caused by the wire. The allegation was that the wire had been placed around Edwin's neck after he was killed to frame the Smeddles for a more vicious murder than had actually occurred. Taking the time to make and use a wire garrote and then additionally stabbing the victim would, of course, not be consistent with self-defense of two people against one. So Klatzau's evidence would be helpful to the defense to try and take the garrotes out of the picture. Klatzau testified that he believed the cuts to Edwin's neck had been caused during the stabbing attack, and the garrotes had been placed over the wounds after that. He'd carried out a simulation with a piglet corpse whose skin is similar in nature to humans, to test his theory, and presented those findings in court. He told the judge that he was so confident that such a garret would not cut into human skin that he was willing to demonstrate such in court with his own assistant. The judge declined the demonstration, saying, "You have a very brave assistant." After Klatzer completed his evidence, the defense continued on with their case. But time after time, delays and postponements pushed the trial further and further back on the court roll. Unfortunately, this delay would be deadly for at least one more person. After the Smedels were released on bail, they'd moved, with permission, to an apartment block in Table View. The couple soon became friendly with the caretaker and fellow residents of the apartment block, 71-year-old Robert Simmons. It's unknown whether Simmons knew that the couple were out on bail on murder charges, but he clearly gained a soft spot for Bridget, Craig, and their young son. Bridget started to clean Robert's home for him twice a week, and soon the man was loaning money to her. Craig would later claim that he'd known nothing about the loans his wife was taking from their elderly neighbour. In the early days, the loans were small and paid off quickly, but it wasn't long until repayments came few and far between, and the amounts Bridget needed became larger and larger. At some point, the Smedels' son was made a beneficiary on Simmons' will. Now, this is undoubtedly very strange, considering Simmons only knew the couple for a few years, but there also has never been any proof that Simmons actually did this willingly. Craig Smedels was known to be quite the effective forge, and had committed fraud on several occasions. So it's entirely possible that the will was forged. But again, this has never been confirmed in any of the resources I could find. Either way, the Smedels continued to ingratiate themselves into Robert Simmons' life, often using their son as a pawn to get money out of the elderly man. On the 16th of July 2014, Robert Simmons' neighbours became concerned that they hadn't seen the man for a while and began to search for him. One neighbour was able to make entrance into his garage and found that his car was not there. Heading through the interleading door from the garage into the house, the neighbour started to see some frightening signs near the bathroom. Drag marks in blood led to the room, and there in the bath, which was half filled with water, lay Robert Simmons, face down. The man was very clearly dead, and neighbours fled the house and called police. When Table View police arrived at the scene, they found 71-year-old Robert Simmons had been murdered. The man had been stabbed in his neck, beaten over the head, and strangled with one of his own shoelaces. Someone had attempted to clean up the scene, and a bloodied towel and yellow cleaning gloves covered with blood were found in the bathroom, which were collected as evidence. Although there was no forced entry into Robert's house, there were signs of a robbery. All of the man's power tools were missing, as was his vehicle. Interviews with shocked neighbours in the complex would reveal that on the last day Robert was seen alive, an argument had been heard coming from his house. Witnesses said that they'd heard two male voices and a female. One of the male voices they could identify as Robert, and many believed that the other two voices were that of Craig and Bridget Smedel. Police were informed of the couple's close relationship with Robert and the fact that Bridget had access to the man's house twice a week to clean. Of course, it didn't take long for the couple to become prime suspects, especially once their criminal records were checked and the IO discovered that they were on bail while on trial for another murder. Over the days after Robert's murder, the evidence started to build against the couple too. Some of the power tools taken from the victim's home were found in a local Cash Crusaders store, where they'd been sold on the day of the murder. The manager of the store noted that a white female had come in to sell the items. Then, as police on this case started to communicate with investigators from Edwin Chukwumba's case, a hugely valuable piece of information came in. One of the drug dealers the Smedels had previously dealt with came forward. He'd realized that he'd been sold Robert Simmons' vehicle and didn't need the trouble of being found with a stolen car and possibly being implicated in a murder. He made contact with one of the IOs in Edwin's murder and told him he had information about a murder in Table View. He handed over the vehicle and provided a formal statement about who had sold him the car: Bridget and Craig Smedel. The couple were arrested shortly after the lead came in. Quite bizarrely, despite them being out on bail for another murder they were accused of, both Craig and Bridget were given bail on this case too. The residents of the apartment block where Robert Simmons had been murdered were certainly not happy to see the couple reappear, and a very uncomfortable atmosphere settled. As investigations continued, it became clear that Bridget was in serious debt to Robert Simmons. The elderly man had continued to lend her money, and she'd simply stopped paying him back. With the addition of the items that had been stolen and sold, being free from this debt certainly seemed motive enough for murder. On top of that, of course, was the rather suspicious fact that the Smedel's minor son was a beneficiary on Robert's will, and it seemed that there was a pretty strong case against Craig and Bridget. With this strong prima facie case, I again cannot really fathom why these two were given bail, and this bizarre behaviour by the courts would only continue when one of the witnesses in this case came forward to say that the Smedels had tried to bribe him into changing his testimony. The drug dealer who'd been sold the victim's car told police that he'd been approached by Bridget, who offered him a sum of money to claim that he'd been mistaken about their identity and they had not sold him the car. He said she had also threatened him if he refused to do so. Despite intimidation of witnesses being completely against her bail conditions, Bridget's bail was not retracted, and she remained out on bail. She was, however, warned, and a charge of intimidation was added to her charge sheet for Robert Simmons' murder. In August 2015, Bridget and Craig were both found guilty of the murder of Edwin Chukwumba. Their significant drug habit was seemingly considered a mitigating factor, and they were given 15 years each for the crime. And now, you might be thinking, well, this is surely when they're taken into custody and have to start serving their sentence for Edwin's murder, right? And then they'll continue on with the trial for Robert's murder from the safety of state custody. Well, no, that's not what happened. Despite now being convicted murderers, the couple were both released on bail, again, until the outcome of the second trial. I don't know. Maybe there's some legal reasoning I'm missing here, but I cannot understand this. Yes, they would have been allowed to appeal their sentence and conviction for Edwin's murder, and sometimes defendants are given bail while they await that opportunity. But they were also up for another murder. Anyway, whatever the reasoning was, the convicted murderers remained out and awaited their trial for Robert Simmons' murder. When that began, the pair once again pled not guilty, except this time they did not claim self-defense. In the murder of Robert Simmons, they claimed that they had not committed the murder at all. Rather, their plea statement said that they would show that they had been set up by drug dealers who were unhappy that they had stopped using drugs and wanted to retaliate against them. The couple claimed that the drug dealers had planted evidence to make them look guilty and stolen Simmons' car and power tools, planting the latter at the Cash Crusaders with a white female who looked like Bridget, and then claiming that they'd sold one of the drug dealers the car. Craig claimed that he'd experienced difficulties with drug dealers throughout the years whenever he got clean, and even if he didn't owe them any money, they would continually pester him and taunt him and Bridget to get back onto drugs. This, they claimed, was why they had framed him and his wife for Robert's murder. The state had a significant amount of evidence against Bridget and Craig, though. In addition to everything I've already mentioned, they also found both of their DNA on items used to clean up the blood after Robert's murder. Now, yes, Bridget cleaned Robert's house, so it wouldn't be strange for her DNA to be there. And there are ways she could have transferred touch DNA from Craig to the scene when she was cleaning. But the amounts of DNA from Craig that was found and the places in which they were found did not speak to a transfer of touch DNA, but rather him and Bridget actually physically having been on the scene when the murder took place. In addition, of course, with them having been found guilty of Edwin's murder, it was clear that the modus operandi in that case was almost identical to what had happened with Robert. Both men were stabbed and strangled. Both men had loaned, albeit in different ways, money to the couple. The couple benefited significantly from both men's deaths. And the couple had not denied being involved in Edwin's death. They'd simply claimed it had been self-defense. So it seems strange that their so-called self-defense murder would have been almost identically duplicated in circumstance in another murder of a man who just happened to live next door to them, but who they were not guilty of killing. Also, let's just look at this claim of the drug dealers killing Robert to frame the couple to get back at them for stopping using heroin. I don't deny that most people who deal drugs are far from the most honest of citizens. And yes, if you owe a drug dealer money, you are in big trouble. And sure, they don't want you to stop using, which is why they supply on credit sometimes, because you're a moneymaker for them. It's horrible, because drugs destroy lives, but there is absolutely no shortage of drug users. Heroin is the most commonly injected drug in South Africa. While it's impossible to know exactly how many people are addicted to which specific drugs, a study conducted in 2010 on heroin users in Cape Town found that the majority of heroin users injected daily, and the Western Cape also has the highest levels of drug use in the entire country. Drug dealers are not desperate for clients. And while I wouldn't put it past them to occasionally contact a user trying to get clean and attempt to get them back on drugs, if that person didn't owe them any money, I cannot see them going as far as faking a murder to get back at them for stopping. Also, that would be pretty pointless, because then they'd go to jail and they wouldn't be buying from them anyway. I've learned never to say never. But really, this one does not make even the slightest amount of sense to me. What does make sense is that Craig was a lifelong criminal. Bridget, too, didn't seem above criminal activity. Both were lifelong heroin users, and neither did a very good job of holding down employment for a very long time. They wanted the easiest way out of their debts. They wanted money that was not theirs, and they were willing to do whatever it took to get it. In both the murders the pair stood trial for, the prosecutors believed that both Bridget and Craig had played a direct role in the murders. It was believed that Craig had done the strangling while Bridget had stabbed the victims. And by 2016, it was clear that the judge agreed to. Bridget and Craig were found guilty of murdering Robert Simmons, and they were handed down life sentences for the crimes, plus additional sentences for the related crimes such as theft and intimidation. Finally, the twice convicted murderers were taken into custody to start serving their sentences. Now, technically, because Edwin and Robert's murders were committed separately, the pair should have had to serve the two sentences consecutively, starting with the 15 years and then commencing the life sentence after that. But the life sentence really overrides that, because they'll be under the auspices of the Department of Correctional Services for the rest of their natural lives anyway. I just hope that in 25 years, when they come up for parole, the fact that they are essentially serial offenders will also be placed before the parole board, and they won't just look at the last murder as the reason they're imprisoned. As killer couples go, Bridget and Craig are different. They met very young and stuck together from that point through thick and thin. If there had been a big age gap between them when they met, that would be an added dynamic. But there wasn't. They were both children when they met, just a year apart. The one missing piece here is knowing more about their personalities. If we look at their actions, each seemed to take equal action in different ways, and Bridget even approached drug dealers on her own, so it didn't really look like she felt she needed Craig's backup. She seemed quite confident to act independently. One of the other things that makes them quite unique is that they never turned on one another. Craig did, at one time, say that he'd know nothing about Bridget having borrowed money from Robert Simmons, nor that their son was a beneficiary on his will, but there was none of the usual finger-pointing. They remained united right up until the end. Which only makes me wonder again about the power dynamic. And perhaps it really was far more equal in this instance than in other killer couple scenarios. There's an interesting condition that sometimes presents itself in killer couples, which, although I don't think it was present here, is worth noting. Hebristophilia is a paraphilia which involves a sexual interest in those who've committed crimes. Paraphilia is a term that describes a scenario which creates sexual arousal in a person that does not involve another consenting adult. There are harmful paraphilias, when harm is caused to another or to the person with the paraphilia when acting on the arousal, and there are non-harmful paraphilias. Hebristophilia can really be either, because being aroused by a partner who commits crimes does not necessarily mean one will participate in those crimes, or that those crimes are ongoing or harmful in any way to the participant. When hebristophilia escalates to a killer couple scenario, of course, it is harmful, and it's commonly referred to as Bonnie and Clyde syndrome. Of course, it's important to note that living with a paraphilia is not a legal defense for committing crimes. When the paraphilia involves illegal activity, the person is responsible for seeking professional help to deal with that paraphilia in a healthy way, and it will not preclude them from prosecution or being found guilty of a crime. The Smedel's minor son really is one of the victims here, I think. Thankfully, his mother's family was able to take him in, and he lives with them now. But I can't help but think how difficult it's going to be for him to come to terms with the fact that his parents did what they did. I find Bridget and Craig quite bizarre, to be honest. And yes, I'm sure their long-term drug use played a major role in where their lives ended up. But there are millions of drug users in the world who do not commit one murder, never mind two. I live in Tableview, where they committed their second murder. I realized when researching this that they would have committed this crime just before I moved here. And that made me think about my neighbors, about your neighbors. And how that lovely young couple with the little boy next door might not be who you think they are. It might be easy to dismiss Edwin Chukwumba's murder as you live by the sword, you die by the sword. But regardless of what he did for a living, and any of our personal opinions about that, that would very simply be victim blaming. Just like we don't know the circumstances of what gets people into any difficult situation, we don't know what led to Edwin selling drugs. And really, it doesn't matter in this context, because regardless, he did not deserve to be murdered. Robert Simmons was just trying to help the lovely couple next door. He gave and gave and gave, until he started to realize he was being manipulated. And perhaps the lovely couple were not so lovely after all. I can't imagine the horror that must have gone through his mind when the pair finally pounced on him and savagely attacked him like that. I don't know why these two were given so much leeway by the legal system. Perhaps we'll never know. Maybe they were just good at manipulating people. Maybe they'd gotten so good at using their drug habits as an excuse for their behavior, that was all they needed to do. Either way, if they'd been in jail in 2014, Robert Simmons wouldn't have died the way he did. But that's the nature of predators. They look like the couple you met last night at that bar. They don't come with a warning sign on their foreheads. Unfortunately, their true nature is only always apparent far too late. Edwin Chukwumba, Robert Simmons, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.